How do you do? Jen and Cam feel it would be unkind to present this program without a friendly word of warning. We are about to unfold our true crime podcast, a podcast of lifelong friends who seek to examine crimes which were committed without reckoning upon God. The discussion will be frank, and the subject matter will be of a grim and violent nature. I think it will thrill you. It might even horrify you. So, if there are young children listening, or if you feel unwilling to subject your nerves to such a strain, now is your chance to... Well, we've warned you.
Hey, Jen.
Hey, Cam. How are you?
I'm back.
Woo-hoo!
Who's back? Who thought we'd have to sing that song twice this summer?
Exactly.
Right?
Woo. Welcome back to the shit show.
And we're here. Take a seat. Take a seat. Anywhere.
Brought alcohol.
Really.
Exactly.
There's nobody at the shit show. Anywho, Jen, I'm sure people have noticed that we took a little unexpected hiatus. I just wanted to say thank you. My father passed away, and it was pretty traumatic and stressful. He was old. He lived a great life, but it was just kind of, it was just a little tough. Let's just go that way. But some of you guys all reached out to me, and I appreciate it more than you know. And some of you guys I got back to, some of them I didn't. They have no service out where they live. So usually all day long when I was out there, I couldn't even talk to anybody. So I just wanted to say thank you guys from the bottom of my heart. It means a lot.
That was something. I went to the service. It was a very nice service. And I will say Cam's dad had the most awesome sense of humor. He was a funny guy. But the last song he had playing in at his funeral was Stayin' Alive.
And
it was fantastic. I mean, I never wanted to dance at a funeral. But when that song comes on, you can't. It was amazing. Amazing. It made me laugh.
He pre-did this, so he picked that out, I don't know, like 12 years ago or something. I don't know. It just made my heart so happy. Because
I loved it.
Like, that's
I
awesome.
Loved it. That's how you should celebrate, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Totally agree.
I don't want to cry, but yeah.
No.
Exactly. So yeah.
So anyway, that's it. I went back to school, started next week, so the routine's about ready to kick in, but it's not because it's the COVID routine. So our routine is not really a routine. So we'll see how that goes, you know, and you're in the same boat as I am.
Recording this on a Sunday. My kids go virtual tomorrow. Half the school does hybrid, and then my kids, we chose virtual because of my husband has a blood disorder and I take medicine that makes my immune levels go down. We still don't know what's going on. So we haven't been told.
Me neither. So, I'm living it. So there you go.
I'm doing Instacart today and we're ordering extra adult beverages to get us through this week and we're going to be fine.
All right, Jen, I hear you got a good case for us today.
I do. You ready?
I'm ready.
Jump into it?
All right. Let's do it.
David James Hendricks was born right outside Chicago in 1955. His father, Charles, was an electrical engineer, and his mother, Laverne, stayed at home, making sure David and his six other siblings were taken care of. Could not imagine having seven kids. The Hendricks family were members of a religion called the Plymouth Brethren. Now, I had never heard of this religion before, and I couldn't find a lot of it, what it was online. But basically, from what I gather, this religion believes in a fundamentalist interpretation of the New Testament in the Bible. So they follow the New Testament word for word, and they apply it to every element of their lives.
Ugh.
So the followers of this religion, they don't worship in a church, nor do they have like a clergy. There's no ministers or priests, nothing. What they do is they gather at someone's house or like a VFW hall or something. And they do this three times on a Sunday and maybe two other times during the week. And men, of course, are the only ones that lead the prayer and worship. Women do not speak at all.
Oh,
during the church or during services, right? The families usually only keep to the other people that follow their religion. They'll do conferences and stuff. It kind of reminds me of the 20 Kids and Counting, that show. They're not quiverful, but they're more Pentecostal in their beliefs. They don't really have any set prayers. Like, they don't do Our Fathers. They don't do, you know, it's just a very straight religion.
Gotcha.
They usually get together with everybody in their area to celebrate Christ, right? So the Bible conferences is basically how David would meet his wife, Susan. Now, the Hendricks family had met the Palmer family in the 1960s, and the Palmers had held a gathering for young people in their faith in their home in Delavan, Illinois, which is a small town about 3 hours south of Chicago. David was 15 at the time and pretty much fell in love with Susan the first time he met her, even though she was a year older. They started dating about 2 years after they first met, and within months, they were secretly engaged. Now, David, this was the very first person David had actually dated in his entire life, so it got serious pretty quickly. David, who was really smart, was able to graduate high school after his junior year due to the fact that he took extra courses during the school year, and he took summer classes, so they allowed him to graduate early. Now, a visit from a family friend by the name of Hans Brinkmann helped him decide where he was going to go next. Hans Brinkmann had a prosthetic and orthotics business, and they manufactured and helped fit artificial limbs and braces on folks. Brinkmann said that he would help with the cost of David's education cost if, in return, David would work for him after David finished college. And of course, David jumped at the chance. Free college, who wouldn't, right?
No kidding.
In July of 1973, David and Susan married in a small ceremony at the American Legion Hall in Delavan, Illinois. That's where Susan's from. Since the brethren's faith, they don't have clergy, a Mennonite minister was the one that did the ceremony. And a side note, just how close these brethren families, how close they get. Vernon Buchanan, who married David's older sister, Bonnie, was David's best man, right?
Oh, uh-huh.
Vernon's brother, Jerry, would later marry Liz, who was Susan's maid of honor.
Oh.
Yeah. So it was like they're very close and, you know, they all hung out together. They didn't go outside their religion for other friendships. Let's put it that way. By the spring of 1974, David and Susan found out that they were going to have a baby. And they also bought their first home, which was a fixer-upper. But David was able to save up the money for the down payment. He was only making $3.20 an hour at the orthotics manufacturer. But to supplement his income, he was also flipping used cars. He had a real talent for it. He could find the best deal and then flip it for really good money. So basically, that's what he started to do, flipping cars and later flipping houses. In September, the couple had a baby girl named Rebecca. And within a year, the couple was pregnant again. And this time, David decided he was going to set out on his own orthotics business. 2 weeks after their second daughter, Gracie, was born, the Hendricks family packed up, sold their house for double what they originally bought it for, mind you, and moved to Galesburg, Illinois, which is just over an hour away from Susan's family. David had the opportunity to work as a self-employed orthotics, and he had contracted space at the hospital, at the Galesburg Cottage Hospital, by the way. So the family bought another fixer-upper house and began renovation. A few months into his new job, David wasn't happy. So his business left him no free time for the family, the church, and his house renovations. And, you know, so he sold the business to the hospital and became a hospital employee. David kind of got in a little pay dispute where the hospital told David to quit or be fired.
Oh.
So David's 22. What does he do? So he starts just renovating houses to sell, and he probably did about six that year. And he was flipping cars, and he started doing missionary work for the brethren. But all the while, David was still thinking about orthotics. David had this idea for this new type of back brace for people who suffered from compression fractures. So Rebecca was soon going to be starting school. Susan was pregnant again with her third child, and David decided it was really time to just settle down and get everything going. So he did some legwork research, and he moved the family once again, but this time he went to Bloomington, Illinois. There he founded the Illinois Orthopedic Appliances. He opened up the business in a building, a run-down building nonetheless, in downtown Bloomington. And the company fitted and sold braces and artificial limbs. They also provided wheelchairs, crutches, and other healthcare appliances. And within 4 months of opening, Susan gave birth to their baby boy, Benjamin. So now they have Rebecca, they have Gracie, and they have Benjamin. All three. Happy little family of five. The business was very successful within a year. David then filed a patent for his compression brace. And also started taking flying lessons and bought himself a Cessna plane for $31,000.
He's a busy fella.
This is in like the late 70s, so he's doing really well. He was taking flying lessons, and he justified this fact that he was fitting customers within a 50-mile radius of Bloomington, so it'd be just easier to fly everywhere. By 1981, David's brace, called Cash, because that's what it brought in, I'm telling you. It stood for cruciform anterior spinal hyperextension, because that rolls off your tongue really easily. Mm-hmm. So they
that's
just called
what I
it Cash.
That's totally what I would have thought that meant. Mm-hmm.
And everybody wanted it. It was totally in demand. So David decided he was just going to sell the Illinois Orthopedic Appliances and just open a Cash manufacturing business, which really is what it did. The sales were unbelievable, and by the first 3 months of 1982, the company had tripled its sales of the previous year.
Wow.
So tripled its sales within 3 months of an entire year is amazing. In July of 1981, the Hendricks moved into 313 Carl Drive, into a two-story home that David built for his family in an up-and-coming area of Bloomington. And within 2 months, he had it paid for in cash, the $92,000 house.
Wow.
In 1981, Becky and Grace were set to go to Stevenson School, which was just a short distance away, and Susan stayed home with Benjamin. And, you know, pretty much since the religion didn't allow women to work outside of the home. Now, Susan ran a very tight ship. In fact, Susan was the homemaker. She spent most of the days cleaning and caring for her family. Some days when David needed help at the Cash manufacturing plant, she helped him out there, but most of the time she was at home cleaning, getting the family what they needed. And sometimes she would get a little down because she did have medical problems that wouldn't allow her to be as fertile as she wanted. I think she had a hysterectomy. And so she couldn't have the big family that she wanted to have. But relatively, she was happy with her life.
Yeah.
Her and David, match made in heaven. They was jealous. At one point, they were in the book that I got a lot of this information out. They put diary pages of hers. And it's like, David took her everywhere. I mean, she had three kids and they were able to, like, even when they were babies, they like went out on dates and they did things. And,
oh, that's nice.
You know, it's very nice. Susan also made sure that the Plymouth Brethren practices were put in place in the household. No eating between meals. No television, no radios, no newspapers, nothing. They did have a record player, but that was to play religious music only. The family didn't celebrate Halloween or Christmas. And I know, if there were parties being held at school, Susan would put the kids up. They weren't allowed to participate. They would pass out treats on Halloween, like, but the kids couldn't go trick-or-treating themselves. But they would go to the zoo. They'd go shopping at the mall. They'd eat in restaurants. And they, of course, would go to Bible conferences, which David would plan business trips around. By 1983, Cash Manufacturing was basically a cash cow. In January alone, it brought in $50,000, or in today's money, $130,000.
That's incredible.
30 days. It is incredible. So David then set up the Bloomington Fellowship Fund, which helped out fellow Christians if they needed help. And most of the money went to people David hardly knew or people that his father suggested the money should go to. So he was kind of a philanthropist.
Mm-hmm.
In the summer of 1983, David took his family on vacation a lot. He also took Susan to London, England, for 2 weeks in September. And things in their life had never been better. On Monday, November 7th, 1987, Susan went to the doctor and they found a small nodule on her thyroid. And she made an appointment for an ultrasound the next day and went to go see David at his office. And they ate lunch together and decided, since Susan had a baby shower that evening, David would take the kids out to dinner at their favorite restaurant so Susan didn't have to cook. She could just go home, go to the shower. So after Susan left for home, David finished making a list of orthopedic practices he wanted to visit on the trip that he had made planned for the next day. His plan was, and it's very smart for a salesman, he would drive up to Wisconsin and then work his way down selling his cash back brace, right?
Yeah, that's pretty good.
So he would drive up at night and then come back down the next day. So David came home at 4 p.m., kind of tinkered with his motorcycle that he had, and then he, I think, took it up to the hangar at the Bloomington Normal Airport where he rented, you know, space for his airplane and his motorcycle, obviously. It was only 2 miles away. And then he jogged home and played with the kids for a little bit. At 5:30, Susan left for the baby shower, which is about 40 minutes away. David took a shower, wrangled the kids in the car, and they were headed to Chuck E. Cheese.
Right.
That's what
Chuck E. Cheese.
It's where kids can be a kid.
That's right. And adults can get alcoholic beverages to help make it
easier. Make the time go by. Warm beer, but it's still beer.
Ugh.
But they first stopped up the mall. It seemed that Becky had won a ribbon on some artwork that she had done in school, so they wanted to stop by the mall and check it out. So they finally made it to Chuck E. Cheese at around 6:30, and they ordered a medium veggie pizza and a pitcher of root beer. And David, being the adult, which adults do, went and found a place to chill while the kids went and played. They did the ball pit, you know, mm-hmm. all the good video games that the kids play at Chuck E. Cheese.
Ski ball.
Mm. Oh, Chuck E. Cheese hell. I'm so glad my kids are too old for Chuck E. Cheese now.
I think they went
out of business, didn't they?
I think they did.
And around 7:30, David tried to gather the kids to get ready to go. But as you know, they never want to go the first time. So he told them to just stay there. He needed to go get some fuel. He needed to fuel up the car. And he told the kids that he'd go do that. And by the time he got back, they needed to be ready. While David was getting gas in the car, he remembered that it was bookmobile day in the neighborhood. God, I loved bookmobiles. Do you remember the bookmobile?
I don't. I was just trying to think of that.
It was like this huge Winnebago, but it was filled with books.
And it would come to your neighborhood.
Uh-huh. And you could go in there and you would, it was a library. Your library did it. So you would go in there.
Oh, okay.
Do your library card and then check out books. And then it would come in a few weeks or the next month and you would go return books. I loved the bookmobile. Loved it. They don't do those anymore around here.
I don't remember it ever coming by my house. The ice cream truck did.
Well, ice snow cones too. So anyway, David remembered that the bookmobile was going to be in his neighborhood, and Gracie and Becky had books they needed to return. So at 7:30, and he thought the bookmobile was going to leave by 8, so he had hurried back, rounded up everybody, left, quickly drove home, sent one of the girls in to get the books, and then they drove to about a block away where the bookmobile was. The kids picked out some new books. They were lucky because the bookmobile actually left at 8:15 and not 8 o'clock, so they had plenty of time. So the kids got new books, and they were able to leave and be home by 8:10 in the evening.
Mm-hmm.
David and the kids played a game of hide-and-seek, and then David put them to bed around 9 o'clock. Susan came home from the baby shower about 10:30, talked with David for a bit, and then went to bed. And then shortly after that, at night, David left for Wisconsin. He was going to drive all night, hit Wisconsin in the morning, and then start his journey back, mm-hmm. which always seems weird. But you know what? When my husband was traveling before this pandemic thing happened,
mm-hmm.
he would always leave and drive all day. Like, he could do short stints of 24 hours, being up for 24 hours straight.
Mm-hmm. No, not me.
So David arrived in Wausau, Wisconsin by about 9 a.m. the next morning, Tuesday, November 8th, and started making his sales calls, slowly making his way south to come home. By noon, David checked into the Red Roof Inn at Madison, Wisconsin, which was 140 miles away from where he started. He made some sales calls in the area, and then he tried to call his wife at about 3 p.m. He wanted just to let her know that this is where he was stopping. He wanted to catch her before she left to go to this family dinner that was at her sister's house. Or no, her sister-in-law's house, her brother's house. Mm-hmm. Nobody answered the phone. So David left to grab a bite to eat and then called the office at 4. And then asking Bev, which was his secretary slash office manager. She was basically the only other person that worked at the business. Mm-hmm. Just to ask, you know, have you heard from Susan? She said she hadn't heard from Susan at all. So David gave her the number of the Red Roof Inn and asked her to give Susan some info that if she did call that, you know, this is where I was, blah, 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 blah. Bev said that, you know what, she would try to get in touch with Susan herself. And David said he was going to try to get to sleep since he hadn't slept basically since Sunday night. At 5:30, David tried the house again. Still no answer. He then tried to call Susan's brother and spoke to his sister-in-law. They hadn't heard from Susan either. Susan's mother was also worried about Susan, and she thought that maybe Susan had gotten some bad news at the doctor's appointment, because remember, she had mm-hmm. that doctor's appointment for the ultrasound in the morning, and she thought that maybe she was trying to stay away from everybody. She just wanted mm-hmm. to think. She didn't want to talk to anybody.
Right.
David called the neighbor by the name of Karen Kramer and asked if they could go over and knock on the door. You know, maybe the phone was off the hook. Remember the old days where...
Oh, yes, I do.
Uh-huh. No one answered the door. Karen went and asked some of the other neighbors if the kids had even been in school that day, and nobody remembered seeing the kids either. Not at school, not playing outside, nothing.
Mm-hmm.
So at 6 p.m., David decides to call the Bloomington Police Department. They told him that they would swing by the house and do a check-in, you know, and David said, well, my neighbor had just been there, and there is nobody home, so it'd be no use if you would swing by there. He also called the sheriff's department and the state police to see if there'd been any car accidents. There had been no car accidents reported.
Mm-hmm.
And at 7 p.m., David checked out of his hotel room and made his way home. He was getting really nervous, couldn't get in touch with his family. When he was about 90 miles away from Bloomington, he stopped at a payphone to call the Kramers again to see if they had heard anything, and there was no mm-hmm. answer. But they kept saying that they'd keep going by and they'd keep calling and try to get in touch. Susan's brother, Nate, and her brother-in-law, Jerry, jumped in the car and headed to Susan's house. And Susan's mother called the Bloomington police. Susan's mother called the Bloomington police, and they said that they would send officers out to meet David at the house and search the premises. They
so
were getting
creepy.
Everybody was getting worried.
Mm-hmm.
Nate and Jerry were at the house when Officer Hibbins and Detective O'Brien arrived at 10 p.m. No one had a key to the house, but found that the back sliding glass door was unlocked.
When the Not open, though, right? Just
it
unlocked?
It wasn't open. It was just unlocked.
Okay. Huh. Okay.
When Officer Hibbins and Detective O'Brien entered the house, they saw that it was a bit messy. There were things that were out of place. Like cabinet doors around the house were left partially opened. They said it looked like somebody had been looking for something in a hurry. So Officer Hibbins made his way upstairs with Detective O'Brien behind him, and they turned on the light, the hall light.
Mm-hmm.
When Hibbins glanced in the first room at the top of the stairs, he was able to see a figure on the bed and whispered to O'Brien that someone was sleeping in that room. O'Brien went into the room, and Hibbins made his way to the next bedroom, where he found an empty, rumpled bed. Drawers had been open in the dresser. It was kind of tipped over a little bit.
Uh-huh.
So he left, and he went into the next room, and he could see there were figures laying on the twin beds that were in the room. Hibbins slowly panned his flashlight across the room, trying not to wake anyone in case, you know, the light hit their face. He didn't want to wake anybody up in case they were sleeping. But
Early.
When he did, he saw a 9-year-old girl laying in blood-soaked sheets. Shining the flashlight on the other twin bed, he saw another girl, around 7, and a small, younger boy, also covered in blood. By the time Hibbins called O'Brien to be in the room, O'Brien informed him that the person in the first room was also dead. Now, the scene was gruesome by flashlight, and the detective and officer said that when the lights came on, it was even worse than they could imagine. The beds were soaked in blood, and the white walls were just spattered with blood.
Ugh, it's terrible.
The oldest girl, Becky, had one gash on her forehead. It started at the hairline, and it went to her left eye. Gracie, or Grace, had multiple lacerations to her face, and there had been a blow to the left side of her face that had left a deep indentation from the corner of her eye to her ear. The blow had been so powerful, it actually opened up a quarter-size hole in her skull.
Ugh.
And her throat had been slashed from ear to ear. And poor little five-year-old Benjamin, he had the worst of the injuries. Like, I'm not even going to say. They were mostly to his face. His injuries were that bad, and his throat also was slit. Both girls looked like they had been asleep when they were attacked, but Benjamin was lying on his back, and his head was touching Grace's, with his right leg hanging down at the knee.
Mm-hmm.
So this made Detective O'Brien believed Benji had seen his attacker, and he might have been awake when it happened. Once they had confirmed the kids were dead, they looked closer around the room, and laying in the middle of the bed next to Benji and Grace's body was an axe and a large butcher knife.
Oh, not what I thought you were going to say.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Hibbins and O'Brien didn't see the condition of Susan's body, really. She was laying in the right side of the bed, and she had a heavy blue comforter covering her. But it wasn't until the coroner came in that they knew Susan had been stabbed 9 times, and one was so deep that it went through her body, puncturing her spine. But the worst of the wounds was a 3.5-inch cut that exposed her skull and the first vertebrae of her neck.
Oh, okay.
And that's what mostly was the blow that killed her. So Hibbins and O'Brien leave the scene and head outside. That's where O'Brien informed Nate and Jerry that Susan and the kids were dead, and to which the first thing that Jerry thought of to ask was it a natural gas leak? I mean, you couldn't even comprehend that your family had been murdered.
No. Who's Jerry?
Jerry was Susan's brother-in-law who went with Nate, her brother.
Wow. Yeah. You wouldn't think that, especially if they're all deceased.
Right.
Oh, my
and
gosh.
Such a horrible... I mean, you wouldn't first have they been murdered. You'd think Mm-mm. it was natural mm-hmm. causes. So Hibbins guarded the door to the house, and Detective O'Brien went to call in the murderers. Now, they went to somebody that worked for the city that lived right down the street because they didn't want to call it in over the radio because they knew it would be a media circus. So the officers started to arrive at the scene to conduct a search through the house, and Nate and Jerry waited for David to arrive. And David got there at about 11:15, and there were so many police cars in front of the house that he had to park down the street.
How scary, really.
Mm-hmm. And he walked up. Now, this is where things get he said, she said type things.
Mm-hmm.
Nate and Jerry, the brother-in-laws, have a different view that how David reacted than what the police have to say what David did when he was mm-hmm. first told. So Nate and Jerry tell it this way. They said, as David got close to the house, Nate and Jerry walked up to him. And Nate said, David, your family's gone. Then Jerry said, they're with the Lord.
Oh.
David looked at them both and said, what do you mean? Nate said, they're dead, and repeating what he had been told. And they've been murdered. Or David's knees buckled, and he started letting out this guttural moan. And Nate and Jerry pretty much had to support him, like pick him up.
Mm-hmm.
He's about to fall. And David said, even Benji, even my little Benji, right? And then that's where Nate and Jerry said that Detective O'Brien stepped in. And O'Brien remembers it like this. He said David got out of his car and he moved quickly towards David. And he was only a few feet away when Nate and Jerry took David by the arms. And O'Brien admits that he didn't hear any of their conversation. And O'Brien flashed his bag and said, are you Mr. Hendricks? David said, yes, what's wrong? And then O'Brien said, Mr. Hendricks, your family is inside the house. They've been murdered. Detective O'Brien said that David dropped his head and let out a groan and said, oh, no, did they suffer? Then the detective said the scene was violent Well, they're with the Lord now, is how O'Brien said David responded.
That David said it. Okay.
Detective O'Brien didn't feel that this was the response of a man who had just found out his family was murdered, right? And that there made him think that David was the prime suspect without anything else.
Right.
Just that interaction right there. They call in Detective Charlie Crow, who is known to be quite the interrogation guy. Like, he can get people to talk.
Mm-hmm.
So he was brought in to record an interview with David at the Kramer's house, neighbor's house. So every question Detective Crow asked, David answered very calmly.
I would be hysterical. Like, I couldn't, I can't even put myself in that spot.
Detective Crow thought all of David's answers seemed pretty prepared, and he was just too composed for a man whose family had just been murdered brutally. Once they kind of finished the interview, Detective Crow turned to another officer and said, "He's dirty."
Meaning David's David. Dirty?
David's dirty. Mm-hmm.
Like dirty, like he did it?
Yes.
Okay.
Like he's the murderer.
Mm-hmm.
With that, the police, David gave permission to search the house along with a hangar where he stored his plane and his motorcycles. I mean, David signed everything that they brought. You know, do you give us permission to search your house? He did. He gave them so they wouldn't have to go get a warrant and all that kind of stuff.
Right. He was complying with them.
Yes,
easily,
very
right?
much.
Yeah.
He never said no to anything. At 2 a.m., they brought David to the police station, and Detective O'Brien was given a copy of the recording that Crow did with David to listen to. And then he and Crow talked about it. And when it was done, that was it. Detective O'Brien said that he knew David did it. They knew it. There was no doubt in their mind that
just
David
by
was
the way
the one.
That he talked, though? There wasn't
just
any, like,
by the
a smoking
way that they
gun
acted.
Or anything?
Nope, no smoking gun. Just by the interview and how O'Brien perceived
well, I know
his
a lot
actions.
Of times. Officers get that, you know what I mean? Like, they get that hunch and they follow it. They just, and maybe they've seen it a lot, you know, but I think you could suspect it, but to definitely outright
go
say,
after.
Yeah, that's different.
There's pretty much that to this, they think the detectives got what? Tunnel vision.
Oh, yeah.
We'll put it that way. By 5:30 a.m. Wednesday morning, David signed a search consent so the police could search for blood on his body. He stripped down and photographs were taken of his body. They took his clothes. They searched his clothes for blood. They checked under his fingernails. They looked in his hair. Nothing. No blood.
Now, at this point, were they thinking that he had murdered his family and then went to Wisconsin?
Yes.
Or they are? Okay.
Yes.
So he would have all that. But then what the time of death, I guess? Yeah, that had to be a thing then too, right?
Yeah. Yeah, we'll get to there.
Okay. Okay.
So David cooperated with the police every time. Everything they asked, he did, except he wouldn't take a polygraph test because his lawyer advised him not to. And just because he wouldn't take a polygraph test, this was the cement for that the police needed to know that he was guilty. He was hiding something, because if you're not going to take a polygraph test, you have to hide something, right?
Right, right.
But we know that polygraph tests, you know, really could backfire on you. It's smart not to take a polygraph test.
I wouldn't take one.
Mm-mm. So, this is interesting. At 1 a.m. on Thursday, after the murders, there was a policeman that was put on guard, to stand guard in the house to protect the crime scene.
Mm-hmm.
And at 1 a.m., the phone rings.
In the house?
In the Hendricks house, yes.
Oh, okay.
And he answers it. And on the phone is a female voice, they said sounded young, that said, "Mr. Hendricks, I know the two people who did this. They went to Chicago, and I'm sorry I can't say anything more."
What?
And then hung up.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you know, they couldn't trace it. It was too quick. They couldn't trace it. They couldn't.
But and the cop, the police officer that was on site is the one that picked up the phone. And
yes.
The caller thought it was Mr. Hendricks.
Exactly.
Okay. Okay. All right. Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm thinking in my head. Okay.
So days are going by. David is staying with family and the police keep searching the house. They're looking for clues. They cannot find anything. They search the cash manufacturing, hoping to find bloody clothes or evidence of a cleanup. They searched his hangar at the airport. They pretty much took his car apart, and no evidence was found. The only thing they found were receipts from David's trip. They immediately called the hotel where David had been staying at and told them not to clean the room. So they went up there to search the hotel room. Nothing. Nothing there. They found the route David had taken home to see. They had people searching up and down the interstate looking for anything David might have thrown out of his car that could, you know, like bloody clothes, mm-hmm. thrown him out of his car. Nothing. I mean, they found other things, but they didn't find anything that could be traced to David or right. the murders.
But if he killed them before he even left, I would think he would have killed them, then cleaned up, and then the business trip would have been a ruse, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then he'd have receipts to prove that I was here and all that stuff. So I don't necessarily think they would find anything that way.
You would think.
Okay.
But they're trying to search every aspect.
I got you.
So, and while the house looked like it had been broken into, they couldn't find a window or a door that had been broken. But remember, the police had the backsliding glass door. That was open.
Yeah, right? It was unlocked, right? Or was mm-hmm. it open?
It was unlocked. It was not okay. open.
Okay, well, they could walk right in. That's
they
not,
could.
Yeah.
Susan's purse had been dumped out and gone through, but the house wasn't trashed. Things were just out of place, not mm-hmm. well kept like Susan normally would have mm-hmm. kept it. Even the basement freezer door was left open. So somebody had searched the house, or so it seemed. The only fingerprints found inside the house could be traced back to the family. And police did find a faint shoe print in the kitchen, on the kitchen floor near the patio. They were never able to identify where that print came from. It never matched David's shoes. It didn't match anybody's shoes in the house.
And no officer's shoes.
No, as far as I know, that was okay. never said. But Susan was a good housekeeper. Police were able to determine that the knife and the axe came from the Hendrix's house. When the axe and knife were tested for prints, nothing came up. There weren't even blurred prints on it.
And his prints weren't on it either?
No. They couldn't tell. I mean, they were able to pick up like blurred fingerprints, mm-hmm. but nothing mm-hmm. that they could match.
Right.
And they didn't have any blood on them. But police knew they were the murder weapons because they found small fragments of Benji's and Becky's hair in them. And in fact, there wasn't a lot of blood found in the house other than the two bedrooms. A crime scene technician described it as, quote, the cleanest bloody crime he had ever seen.
Does that mean like the blood was almost as if it was placed there versus, you know, like say
there
it was a
movie. There was no other blood in the house but the bedrooms. Even the murder weapons were free of blood. Like they could not see any blood. And they said it was unbelievable because the analysis of the blood spatters in the girls' room mm-hmm. indicated that the killer or killers stood between the two twin beds, and that when he used the axe, you know, like when he brought the axe down and brought it back up, mm-hmm. that blood would have gotten all over them. There's no way. They couldn't find anything.
Ooh.
They couldn't find any blood spatter besides what's in the bedroom. So police decided to luminol the whole house. Now, and as we know, thanks to Forensic Files, luminol is a chemical that is sprayed on surfaces to detect latent blood stain evidence. So you can clean up blood stains, but it's always going to leave some kind of organic matter there.
That's right. That is right. So you use all that bleach you want, buddy, because guess mm-hmm. what?
It's still going to show. Well, let me tell you a little bit about luminol.
Please do.
Let me tell you. So when luminol hits something that it reacts to, it lights up in like a blue glow, but you have to use certain lights. You have to be in a completely dark room. They sprayed luminol in the house. Nothing came up. But when they sprayed the luminol in the hallway bathroom, the floor of the bathtub lit up.
Oh, so the killer took a shower, I guess?
Well, before you get excited, just know that luminol reacts to other things besides blood. It reacts to bleach.
Oh,
certain household cleaners.
Oh, okay.
That's shampoo.
bubble bath.
We're talking about that. Okay.
Body lotion, horseradish, and horseradish. Pet urine also make Luminol glow blue. So okay. It's not necessarily what Luminol does is it gives you a hint of where to look where it might have been clean, mm-hmm. but then you have to use a second step to make sure mm-hmm. that it's blood. So the police did check the drains, pipes, and P-traps, but there was no evidence of blood in the drains. So, and a P-trap is a plumbing device which prevents, this is a quote, P-trap is a plumbing device which prevents odorous gas in plumbing drains and sewers from rising up through a toilet, sink, or floor drain. But let me just say this. They did not do the second test to make sure that was blood.
Why not?
I don't know. Police had no physical evidence that David had killed his family.
Mm-hmm. I'm seeing that. I'm not liking it. I gotta be honest.
But detectives were still suspicious. And they developed what? We've told this before. Tunnel vision. A lot of people think they developed the police detectives. Yeah.
Like, why would you not test it again?
No.
Test and retest.
They never asked if there was anyone that could have killed David's family. They never explored any other avenues. They were dead set that David was the killer, and only David was the one that killed his family. But they didn't have any evidence. They had no idea. Mm-hmm. When the autopsy results came in, that's what sealed it.
Why?
The stomach contents of two of the kids showed partially digested pizza. And this can get kind of gross, but some of the chunks of the vegetables were still identifiable. Susan's stomach contents were unrecognizable. And because of this, the coroner estimated that the kids were murdered before Susan even got home from the shower. The bridal shower or baby shower.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I'm just thinking. So were the killers lying in wait for her?
No, they think. Here's the timeline that they came up with. The detective figured that David killed the kids after they got home from the bookmobile. Mm-hmm. And then when Susan came home, she went straight to bed without checking on the kids. And then David attacked her after she fell asleep.
I don't know if I buy that, only because I think it's a natural reaction. If you're out late and you didn't see your kids, you go check on. Like, just pop open the door.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm. So this is what they thought happened, but they don't have any evidence. They just need a motive mm-hmm. before they can go to court.
Right.
So police interview family and friends. They interview Susan's family, everybody. And they were all in agreement that David was an upstanding, conservative, religious family man. And mm-hmm. he and David had a wonderful marriage.
Okay. Uh-huh. Well, yeah, but
and
you know,
David
you
was
hear
a loving
all the time.
I know. David was a loving father, and he absolutely adored Benji because he had always wanted a son. Mm-hmm. There were no illicit affairs or child abuse going on, mm-hmm. but the police kept digging. And finally, they hit what they thought was pay dirt. A tip came in that David may have been dating a local model.
Was he?
Detectives went to a local modeling agency and photography studios to check around. And they found out that David, in order to sell his back braces, he had hired models to wear them for his brochures. Mm-hmm. But talking to them, they found out that David actually wasn't having an affair with any of the models. But he wasn't actually a gentleman either.
Oh.
And that's when they arrested David on December 5th, 1983.
They really don't have that much on him. I mean, you know, usually the people closest to you are always the first to be looked at, but still.
I didn't write this down, but I just wanted to be let known that when they arrested David and they brought him in handcuffs to the police station, they had all the models in the room where David was brought into. Right.
Why?
So to me, that's not cool because it gives you the impression that he's guilty because he's in handcuffs. Right.
Well, I'm just thinking the officers wanted supermodels in there to oogle.
They were questioning. They were bringing the models in for questioning.
Oh.
That for like to do the, not questioning, not interrogating.
I got what you. Interview. They're just interviewing them, right?
To file a report. Yeah. To do like a report on David. So everybody that knew David was shocked, and no one believed David had killed his family. And if truth be told, the Illinois state's attorney, Ron Dozier, He wasn't entirely convinced of David's guilt either.
I'm not either. I mean, I'm not saying he didn't do it yet, but I don't think they have enough to definitely. I would not convict if I was sitting on the jury.
Thank you. So, okay. And Dozier was the one who had to actually argue, bring it to court, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, the motive, Dozier argued at the trial, was that David felt trapped in his marriage to Susan, and he was sexually attracted to other women, but couldn't act on it due to his religion, because he would lose standing in his church.
Mm-hmm.
And murdering the kids was just to throw the police off. Mm. So that's what he was taking to trial.
Oh.
Yeah. They said that he would really look guilty if it was just Susan that had been killed, you know?
That's true. They're not wrong.
Exactly. And they said, besides, you know, David might have thought that the kids were better off with their mother in heaven because of his religious beliefs.
Because he was so religious, I almost don't buy that, because to me it seems like they were pretty God-fearing and things like that. So that would be way worse than just getting a divorce or cheating on your wife.
You're going into court with people that have no clue about this strange religion.
But still, if somebody tells me they're religious or are deeply religious, I'm going to kind of guess that they don't really.
You would think that, but this is a weird religion that nobody has really heard of. Have you heard of the Plymouth Brethren before this?
The Ethel Thayer religion?
Yeah.
No, I have not. I have not heard of that.
So that's what he's trying to do.
So they're going to mask it and make it look all shady and scary so that people.
Or since you don't know much about this religion, religion is really creepy. And this is mm-hmm. the only way he could stay in standing is if he kills his family because he's attracted to other women.
Oh, buddy.
You know?
Okay. Yeah.
So you have to remember that the prosecution was going to have to rely heavily on this theory and other circumstantial evidence because there was hardly, if any, physical evidence. Now, I know everybody always says circumstantial evidence is still evidence,
mm-hmm.
but this is really circumstantial evidence stuff. I mean, this is not, I don't know.
I said. I think I would have, you know, in my heart of hearts, I might suspect he did it, but I don't think they really have enough. I don't think I would feel comfortable convicting him and sending mm-hmm. him to death or to prison for life. I mean, they didn't find anything on his body, like under his fingernails or nothing. And you would have that after killing four people.
Mm-hmm. As violently as it did.
Not to mention a psychotic break. But I guess if you are psychotic, you wouldn't break. But still, you know, I don't know. Okay.
So let's get on to the trial here. Much of the trial, the prosecution focused on stomach contents of the victims. This, of course, was because the estimated time of death from the stomach contents proved to the prosecution that the kids died before 10:30, which meant David was the only one home with them at the time. Now, they had five medical examiners brought in to testify for the prosecution. One of them was the famous or infamous Dr. Michael Bodden, who, thanks to Forensic Files, we know all about Dr. Bodden.
Yes, we do.
Each medical examiner admitted to the defense that they weren't experts in digestion and how quickly food digests can change due to different scenarios, like physical activities
mm-hmm.
or how big the meal is. Like if you eat a bigger meal, it's going to digest slower than a smaller meal.
I was just thinking about all this.
How you don't chew, if you don't chew your food properly, that can slow down digestion.
Mm-hmm.
And being the kids being at Chuck E. Cheese, you know they gobbled their food up quickly so they could play, right? Because
mm-hmm. mm-hmm.
good parents, unlike you and I, would make the kids eat before they actually go play.
Oh, heck yeah.
Yeah. So maybe that's why the food wasn't totally digested.
I was thinking, too, if they ate, or maybe they played, then they ate, and then he's like, let's go, and then they went home and went straight to bed, I would think your digestion system would slow down as you slept. I could be wrong.
I have no idea. And the thing is, you know just as much as medical examiners do. Nobody really knows.
That's why I got my degree.
Exactly. Nobody really can tell time of death by stomach contents.
Yeah.
They can estimate it.
Yeah. I think it's 6 to 8 hours for it to move through your stomach, but then for it to move through your body, it's like 24 plus, something like that, if I remember correctly. But
each one can guesstimate, and what it is, but they've all learned from the same book that was published about the time of the Civil War.
Or
so nobody's really checked into it at this time.
Or from forensic files.
Forensic files, exactly. Everybody learns everything from forensic files. Yep. And if not, what do you know, really?
Thank you. Forensic files, you know, that would all have to go. Also, like how much liquid you would drink, eat with your food, you would think, right? So like if you had a ton of liquid, I would think that would make it digest faster.
And my hard physical activities would be different from your hard physical activities. Mm-hmm. So it's confusing.
Just a lot of variables. Yep. Yeah. Okay.
Another medical examiner admitted that he had written two reports on Grace's stomach content. The first one was after the murders happened in November, and he noted that the food, for the most part, had been digested, and he couldn't tell what type of food had been eaten. And then later, he realized that he had actually examined Susan's stomach content twice.
Oh. Oh.
So he wrote a new report in February, and he found only slightly digested black olive, tomato, onion, and large pieces of mushroom. Well, this shocked everybody, especially David and the relatives, because Grace hated mushrooms and refused to eat them. She would never eat them. So it was also found that during the autopsy, the stomach contents were not measured correctly. And a few attendants actually picked out pieces that they felt were important and then put the rest of the stomach contents down the drain. They didn't do procedure properly. Like they picked out, oh, this looks good. I'm just going to pick this piece out and this piece out. They picked and choosed what they put in, or at least one did. Right.
Yeah.
So this, of course, brought up questions if maybe there were mistakes made with the handling of such important evidence.
Well, I'm going to say yes.
Mm-hmm. All the MEs agreed that judging by the time of death by stomach contents is not the best way to do so. And it's not an exact science. And it's just an estimation. So that kind of killed the prosecutor's theory that they were killed at 10:30.
Right.
Or before Susan came home. Another big part of the trial were testimonies of the models David handled for the back brace. They each took the stand at the same order where they were hired. And basically, this just went to show how David progressed in his behavior. The first one said David was the perfect gentleman. But each one told them how David had measured them for a brace fitting, and he told them to adjust to their underwear. First model said, very professional, perfect gentleman. But the later models told of how David asked them to get completely naked to be measured. Some even said that David touched them. One model said that David gave her a massage, stating that since she had a slight curve of the spine from scoliosis, that it would help her fit into the neck brace better. So he was creepy. Let's put it that way. Mm-hmm. He started touching her breasts. Oh. Like one model said that he almost did a breast exam on her, but he never touched her nipples at all. One model said that she thought David was going to kiss her, so she pushed him away. And then another model said David tried to kiss her and she refused. And then later that same evening, she claimed that David asked her. He apologized about the kissing, but then asked her if it would be okay if he could fantasize about her later.
Ew.
Kind of, yeah.
That was just creepy.
So on the stand, David admitted that he was attracted to some of the models. And it said that, yes, it was possible that he wanted to kiss some of them. You know, that they were in intimate conversations. And he would maybe possibly lean in, thinking going in for a kiss or something. But when they stopped him, he stopped and he never redid it, right? Mm-hmm. And as far as asking about if he could fantasize about a model, he flatly refused. And he said, there's no way I would do that. And then he added, you know, just because he acted inappropriate with some of these women didn't mean that he killed his family. And in fact, he said that he loved his family. And that night before he left to go to Wisconsin, he and Susan talked about adopting more children.
So he's just he's creepy. He's just creepy. But creepy does not make you a murderer.
Right. And,
just
you
makes
know,
you creepy.
And, you know, the police were saying that he was very composed and he wasn't showing any emotions or whatever. When he was brought into jail, he wasn't given any. They couldn't bail him out. A lot of the, I guess, correctional officers or the people in the jail would go to look for David and he'd be hiding behind a wall or something, and he'd be crying. And then once they would find him crying, he would straighten up and he would show no emotion. But when he was by himself, he would let his emotion show.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I can see that, I guess. Okay.
Prosecution also mentioned that a year before the murders, David lost a bunch of weight and changed his hairstyle, which added more fuel that David wanted to date other women.
Mm-hmm.
And David explained that it was the doctor who told him to lose weight for medical reasons. And the reason for the new haircut was his old stylist moved and he had to go to a new one. And also in the book, there was a mention that Susan asked him to lose some weight for her birthday. He asked her what she wanted for her birthday and she goes, you need to lose some weight. So he started losing weight then too. The defense made sure that the jury understand that there was not one bit of physical evidence. And they spent months combing through David's house and nothing was ever found. I mean, could not find one piece of evidence.
Yeah.
And they believed that since there was no evidence, the prosecution had to make up a motive and one that focused on his church, a religion that many didn't understand.
Mm-hmm.
The defense called members of the Plymouth Brethren to the stand. They testified that their religion did allow a divorce, but only for adultery. And at the time, there were members of the church then in the congregation that was part of David's circle. There were people that were divorced. And as far as what David did with the models, you know, mm-hmm. kind of pushing the envelope with the models, I mean, he was wrong. He was completely in the wrong about that.
So I said, he's a creep. Doesn't make him murder, just makes him a creep.
Yeah. And as far as all the creepy stuff that David did, the church did frown upon it, but they did not consider that adultery whatsoever. And also, if a person did commit adultery, the person wouldn't be banned from church. They would be what they called set aside. Now, set aside doesn't mean you're shunned, like in the Amish belief. Mm-hmm. If you decide to not be Amish anymore, you're shunned. You can't talk to family members. You can't talk to mm-hmm. friends. Set aside means that you could still go to meetings.
Mm-hmm.
You could still be a part of the church. You just couldn't lead in prayer or you couldn't lead the hymns. You just had to go to church. You could not participate.
Oh, okay.
And after a while, if someone that has been set aside kept showing up to the meetings and kept showing their devotion, they would be restored. Mm-hmm. Right?
So it's a timeout.
Exactly.
You get a timeout. Yep.
Exactly. You're grounded.
Yep.
Right? So prosecution also stated that David had staged the break-in to throw the police off the scent because nothing had been stolen at all. Well, it turns out the defense said the family claimed that a few $100s had been stolen. They also brought in an FBI agent that stated the house looked like it had been robbed by a person or people that had been searching for something in particular.
Mm-hmm. That's what it sounds like to me.
Mm-hmm, to them, or to the FBI agent, it looked to be very methodical. He even suggested that one of David's competitors could have broken in looking for one of his new orthotic brace ideas.
That's a good point.
Mm-hmm. After 9 weeks, the jury went to deliberate. And 2 days later, the jury came back with a guilty verdict.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Which meant David could get the death penalty.
Right. Okay. Did they say like what the defining thing was? The one thing that...
Well, it was because of the models. At first, when, you know, a jury goes in and you take like a blank poll to see who, it was 6-6, right? 6-4, mm-hmm. 6-against. And then as it proceeded on, people started slowly going over to guilty. And when asked, it was because of the models of how...
No evidence, you know, you can... Like Jimmy Carter said in Playboy in the 70s, he had lust in his heart.
Mm-hmm.
That makes you human, not...
Well, and before they even went, the judge said, you have to, since there is no evidence, before you do guilty, you have to make sure there is no reasonable doubt.
Yeah, there's a lot.
Right? There's a lot of doubt in my mind, but I guess the prosecution was really good.
I guess so.
The judge then asked if he wanted the jury to decide his fate or the judge, and he picked the judge. And at the sentencing, the judge said that he personally believed that David probably did commit the murders,
mm-hmm.
but based on the evidence admitted at the trial, he is not personally convinced that he had been proven guilty beyond a reasonable doubt.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Quote, however, as to the sanction of death, I hold the same position as I do, or perhaps even all of the jurors. I cannot, in good conscience, apply the sanction of death unless I have been convinced of his guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. I have not, and mere belief is not enough. And David was given 4 life sentences in prison without parole.
So they didn't give him death because he didn't feel like he...
The judge, he said it wasn't proved. While he did believe that he did it, they didn't prove that he was guilty enough to give him death.
Ew. Okay, so where is he now?
Well, in 1988, David met a woman by the name of Pat Miller. She was a mother of another inmate, and they got married.
She was a model, and I was going to say, really?
She was a mother of another inmate, and they got married in December, and David's mother and Susan's mother came to the wedding.
Oh, so Susan's mother didn't...
No, nobody believes that he really did killed the family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, interesting.
July of 1990, David's lawyer appealed his sentence, and the Supreme Court ruled that the testimony about the models and Hendrick's religion was unfairly prejudicial. But let me do this. Before this, when it first was brought up to the Supreme Court, they said, nope, it's going to stay as it goes. And then for some weird twist of fate, 6 months later, they came back with this. Like somebody actually reread it, the trial, and said, oh, this doesn't sound right. This is unfairly prejudicial.
That's presidential. It's unfairly presidential.
Yeah.
What happened in that 6 months? Do you know? Did they get a new person?
No idea. The Illinois Supreme Court?
Yeah.
No idea, but it worked out for David because his conviction was overturned and he got new trial.
Mm-hmm. Good. And when this was, what did you say, 90? 91?
July of 1990. In February of 91, they did a new trial. And for the prosecution, they went the same way, except they couldn't bring in his religion or they couldn't bring in the models. And when before the jury left to deliberate, David's lawyer told them, quote, we can't prove David Hendricks didn't do it, but we don't have to. The state has to prove that he did it.
Right.
And there is no evidence. No evidence to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he did it.
There really isn't.
Mm-mm.
I mean, not from what I heard.
Nope. And this jury found him not guilty.
Really?
He was released and opened another orthotics business.
He likes those orthotics, David.
He does. Well, he's smart, and it did really well. Like, he actually sold it after a couple years, and he made a ton of money. He got a divorce from Pat, married another woman, and they now have 2 small children.
Wow.
Yeah. But just a side note, in 1989, David wrote a petition to the court stating he believed his former brother-in-law, John Lewis, killed his family.
Why?
And according to David, John never felt like his wife Martha's family, Susan's sister is Martha, never felt that the Palmer family accepted him. And according to David, John really hated Susan and himself because they were part of the inner religious and family circle. Mm-hmm. And they were like the bigwigs in the family.
Mm-hmm.
And they were also financially successful.
I was just going to say, they were doing well.
John wasn't. John also worked at a hospital. By the way, he was like an orderly.
Where's John today?
Well, John didn't let Martha attend the church meetings at all. She wasn't allowed. Mm-hmm. And the baby shower that Susan went to that night she was murdered?
Uh-huh.
It was held by Martha and Susan's sister, but Martha wasn't invited to the shower. And supposedly she cried that night that she wasn't invited to. And this is all hearsay. John and Martha had babysat for Susan and David before, and they actually had a key to the house. John had even borrowed the axe that was in the garage to chop wood before. Quote, shortly after the murders, Hendricks wrote to the court, John brought home a pair of bloody surgical scrubs and told Martha to wash them.
Really?
When investigators asked John, he claimed that he got them from a doctor, right?
The scrubs?
Uh-huh. And John named the doctor.
I mean, orderlies don't really get bloody, do they? I don't think they're the ones.
But why would a doctor give you scrubs?
Yeah.
To
well,
wash.
Either or. No, of course not.
Right. So John said the name of the doctor, and then the detectives went to the doctor, and the doctor denies giving the bloody scrubs to John. And it turned out that the doctor didn't even work at the hospital until months later.
Was it Dr. Frankenstein?
Could be.
Sorry. So he knew that. So right. How did he know that doctor, though?
Well, they worked together afterwards, but he...
Yeah, but you would try to name a doctor that you knew was in the premises, right?
At the time of the murders, right? The doctor wasn't working at the time of the murders. Right. But then it got suspicious, too, because Martha had just divorced John right before David wrote this letter. So at the time of the murders, Martha told police that John had been home the entire night that Susan and the kids were killed. But then afterwards, she confessed this all to David. And when interviewed by the police later, she claimed that John left their house at about 10 o'clock that night, saying that he was going to go lift weights.
Really?
But it's still unsolved because the police still think David did it.
They haven't went after John? Where's John?
No. He's still walking around somewhere in Bloomington, Illinois, or wherever. And even this, like, if he leaves at 10, that would put the kid's stomach contents even in time to make it, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, totally.
It would all add up. But the police still believe that David's guilty, and they're not going after him.
Why would they not, though? That's so stupid.
No idea. Yeah.
Good job, Jen.
Yeah,
but, thanks. So, remember, you guys, lock your doors.
And keep passing by those open windows.
Bye-bye.
Love you. Today's episode was researched and written by me, Jen. For more information about this episode, as well as all other sources, please check out our show notes or the podcast website at ourtruecrimepodcast.com. Our True Crime Podcast is developed and created by the hosts, Jen and Cam. Original music and audio mix of all Our True Crime Podcast episodes is courtesy of Nico Vertese from We Talk of Dreams. You can reach Nico at wetalkofdreams.com. Listener discretion is provided by Edward October from Octoberpod VHS. You can find all of his great works on YouTube. Please make sure to like and subscribe to Our True Crime Podcast wherever you listen to your podcasts. We can be reached on Instagram and Facebook at Our True Crime Podcast or on Twitter with the handle at Our True Crime Pod. You can also email us at ourtruecrimepodcast@gmail.com. We would also at this time like to thank our patrons. We would be so lost without you. Thank you so much. And if you would like to help support the show, you can check us out on patreon.com/ourtruecrimepodcast. You can also show your support by leaving a 5-star review on Apple or simply just tell your friends about us. It's that easy. Love ya. Right? We got it. We got this.
Because next week it could all change. And who knows? Who knows? I'm expecting aliens to land. I seriously would not. In fact, Jennifer called me. Was that 2 weeks ago? Jennifer calls me 2 weeks ago and she says, go outside, take your phone and look up to the sky. And I'm like, are you effing kidding me? You've got to be kidding. And she's like, there's these things out there. Her husband found them. So I go out there and I'm like, oh my God, what is that? What? And I took pictures of it.
They were these lights in the sky that did not move and they were perpendicular to each other. There's three of them. They wouldn't go anywhere. And of course, we don't have binoculars. The only thing my husband had was a really strong telescope on his rifle. So he's out there.
Those neighbors probably were like, they've lost it.
People were walking back and forth. He's up there with his rifle pointing up in the sky trying to find out what those are. And we were telling people, there's UFOs up in the sky. I mean, we're not crazy, but we can't identify what these are. They weren't moving. It was just weird. Did later find out it has something to do with the internet. They were balloons taking something up
into space
or something. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It was just funny.
Right.
But I have a picture of my husband standing out. It's funnier than hell. I'm telling you.
We should put that on Patreon, the picture. I was like, you know. Like I said, I would not be surprised.
Oh, yeah. He's out there shooting a gun into, you know, and
space. Yeah.
Into space.
Very,
and he's got.
Very where we live. Very Jeffco.
Hans. Or
penises.
Heinz. Close. Heinz Brinkmann had a prosthetic and orthotics. Let me. No.
I like penis or prosthetics better.
Yeah.
No. Prosthetics.
Let me just do this.
The
David
penis
was
prosthetics. It's a band.
It was. But all the while, David was still thinking about orthotics, and he was working on this new idea. Because who doesn't? No, who doesn't always think of orthotics? Every
he's
time
living his best life, but he still thinks of. And I thought you were going to say a girl's name, and you said orthotics.
Orthotics. Well, you know, when I go for a walk, I'm always thinking about my orthotics, and
I'm totally.
What
totally seems logical.
Yeah. What you doing? I'm just thinking about orthotics.
Daydreaming. About orthotics.
He opened up the building in a rundown.
Downtown. I want to go downtown.
Downtown. So, Susan also made sure that the Plymouth Brethren, that's hard to say, Plymouth Brethren, practices.
It's like Ethel Thayer.
It's Ethel Thayer.
Ethel Thayer. Plymouth Brethren.
So, he was kind of a philanthropist.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I want to be when I grow up, too.
Me too. Me too.
I just
I want to be the one that gets the money. What's that called? I don't want to give it. I
just need
it.
Somebody to philanthropize, give me the money so I can be a philanthropist. I first should probably learn how to say philanthropist.
Mm-hmm. Ogle? Google?
Well, they wanted,
goggle.
They
whatever. They wanted to stare at him.
This podcast is brought to you by Forensic Files. And then I have an incomplete sentence that I have no idea where I was going. So that's good.
Give me the sentence and we'll play a game and I'll see if I can finish it for you.
Prosecution brought up that since there was no visible...
Hold on. Prosecution brought up since there was no visible evidence to tie him to the crime, he should be let go. However, it's prosecution, so they want him... in. So that
exactly.
Doesn't make sense.
No.
Okay.
So we're just going to skip that.
Okay.